I've been involved with the LSAC since 1989, and so I've learned a lot about the test, and hopefully we'll be able to share some of that with you today. Although, yeah, I see a lot of friendly faces. Good. I was also asked to talk about this article by Conrad Johnson that appeared in the New York Times that's entitled Law School Admissions Lag Among Minorities. And what was surprising reading this article when it initially came out was that the New York Times published it. It didn't really say anything new. It's somewhat misleading in that it compares 1993 to 2008. And 1993, I'm sure not many of you were in the market then, but 1993 was a huge year for law school admissions. It was one of the biggest, if not the biggest year. And so if you compare 93 to 2008 and don't compare the intervening years, you get some distortions. And if you care about minority admissions between 1993 and 2008, what you'll see is that there have been some ups and downs, but essentially, African-American matriculants peaked in 2008, and they have gone down slightly in both 2000, well, they went down slightly last year, and there was a little peak also in 2006, and they went down again in 2007, so there's a little peak and valley action. The numbers, roughly, and I'm just throwing it, roughly about 3,400 African Americans are being admitted to ABA-approved law schools, and the number doesn't vary that much. And so we're talking about small differences, even if you compare 2008 with 1993. What's problematic, and the article does state this, and deans and others have been aware of this, is that the number hasn't grown. While the seats for law students has grown by about 10,000 since the 1990s because of all the new law schools that have been given ABA approval. And that is somewhat troubling that the numbers have not kept pace with the number of additional seats. And so for that, this article is correct. It's also a little bit misleading because it talks about the decline in Mexican Americans. And what he doesn't talk about is that basically between 1993 and now, with the 2000 census, we of course, like everyone else, went in and develop new categories. And so we now, like the census, have 15 boxes, and so you can check boxes. And whereas in 1993, you only had 5 boxes, now you have a lot more boxes. So actually the data, at least with respect to race, especially with respect to Hispanics, is non-comparable. And so that's another thing I would caution you to, well, caution you about. The last thing, and I'll definitely get into this, the thing that troubled me is that in this article, he says, and I quote, even though they're, and he's referring to African-Americans and Mexican-Americans, even though their scores and grades are improving and are very close to those of white applicants, African-Americans and Mexican-Americans are increasingly being shut out of law schools. That's flat out wrong. And so, and I'll talk more about that. So I don't know where that statement comes from. There's no cite for it. And I don't know what metric he's using to say that the scores are the same, giving basically the effect that African-Americans, Mexican-Americans are scoring the same on the LSAT, but not being admitted. As I'll talk about, there's still a significant score gap and a documentable score gap. So I was like, where did that come from? Anyway, okay, so where to start? I wanted to tell you a little bit, a couple of minutes about the history of the LSAT to give you some flavor of the organization and how it started. It's not this big, you know, corporate entity. If you think about testing organizations, there's ETS. And ETS is this big nonprofit. They do a lot of the tests, GRE, GMAT, and they're located in Princeton, New Jersey. The LSAC was incorporated in 1947, and it was incorporated by law school deans. And indeed, one of the founding law schools to incorporate the LSAC was the University of Virginia, and one of the individuals signing the initial articles of incorporation was an old dean, Emerson Spees, the late Emerson Spees. And the problem was this, in 1947, the GIs were coming back from World War II, and they were applying to law school. And before World War II, if you went to Princeton, if you went to Harvard, if you went to Yale, those sort of schools, and you applied to law schools, you had decent grades, meaning C or better, you got into law school. And then after World War II, you had this flood of applicants. And these applicants came from all over. They went to schools like Poughkeepsie State, UCLA, schools that admissions officers had never heard of. And they had no idea how to evaluate these students based on their grades because they didn't know the quality of the schools. So what happened was, if you went to one of these, quote, elite Eastern schools, you got in. If you didn't, you did not get into a law school in 1945, 1946 with the GI Bill. And that created some issues because the people who went to the elite Eastern schools were all WASPs. And so there was no ethnicity in law school. There was no way to sort of include others. And now I'm not talking about African Americans. I'm talking about Italians, Jews, Greeks, whatever. And so these people got together, law school deans, and they came up with the LSAT. And they came up with the LSAT as a tool of inclusion to expand, if you will, the entering classes, ethnicity, to reach out to groups that have been excluded. And it worked very well from 1950 till about 1970 when the issue became, well, how do we get more people of color into our law schools? And I'll talk about that. But essentially, I think this is still true, the LSAC views its organization as one that is beneficial to underrepresented students. And underrepresented students today are African Americans, Hispanics or Mexican Americans, and Native Americans. Asian Americans are no longer underrepresented. And that's why they have a standing committee called the Minority Affairs Committee. And that's why they do things like the fee waiver and some other things. And we can talk a little bit more about that in the Q&A. But essentially, it's a tool of inclusion, and they view the LSAT as providing opportunity for those who can't go or choose not to go to Harvard or Yale or Stanford. They choose to go to Georgia State. They can prove that they belong in law school by taking this test. And so that's sort of the framework, and that's how I sort of view the test. And I took the test. I won't tell you when, but it was way before 1984. Anyway, so the test. Oh, and I should add, the LSAC is still owned by the law schools. And so if you're an ABA-approved law school, and there are now 200, you get to vote on who goes on the board of directors. The board of directors, of course, is the governing body. The board of directors hires the president, the CFO, the CEO, and all that stuff. And there's a volunteer organization. And as Melinda mentioned, I eventually became chair of the board from 2001 to 2003. So it's still a law school entity. And so it still cares very much about law schools and what law schools think about the test. And we've discovered over the years some issues that create some of the problems that lead to, well, less than adequate number of African Americans and Hispanics in law schools. The first thing is there is a score scale differential, and it is greatest between whites and blacks. And it's typically in most administrations, one standard deviation. So if you look at the LSAT, 153 is roughly the average score. The average score for African Americans is still about 143. It went up to 144, but it's roughly 143. You can play around with the number a little bit. Now, what's interesting about that, and people point to that score scale differential, which is the way the psychometricians, you all know what psychometricians are? Psychometricians are people who go to very interesting colleges and get PhDs in test taking. And they study statistics, sociology, psychology. It's a very specialized area of expertise. But those are the people that put together the LSAT and the GRE and the GMAT and all those other tests and the SAT that come up with the item types and do the score scales. And I know a lot of psychometricians. But anyway, the psychometricians would say it's one standard deviation. And the persistence of that gap is real. At one point, it was about 1.5. And so the LSAC is actually quite proud of the fact that they, I think, have the narrowest gap, and that they are narrowing the gap from 1.5 to down to 1. So when you look at standardized tests, you see this persistent score gap in every standardized test in the United States today. And indeed, you can document it as early as second graders taking standardized testing. Now, here's the problem. No one knows why. If you assume that race is not a biological attribute, which I definitely believe it is not, I've written a lot about that, then you cannot point to race as the rationale for that gap. That gap persists along what we call the SES, the socioeconomic spectrum. So the wealthier you are, the better you tend to do on standardized tests, and obviously if you think about it for a minute, that makes sense. But even among the wealthiest blacks, when you compare them to the wealthiest whites, you still see the gap. That's why I say the gap is persistent across the SES spectrum. And that leads to a claim that either the LSAT's discriminatory or all standardized tests are discriminatory. And I don't know about all standardized tests, but I can tell you that I would not be involved with an organization for over 20 years that is discriminatory to African Americans. But that's not why it's not discriminatory. There are other reasons. First is, and you would know this, for every item on, and they call it questions on the test items. So for every item, they do what's called diff analysis. You remember the experimental section that was in your test? I mean, all of you took the LSAT, right? I mean, I'm sorry about that knowledge. And you didn't know, you weren't supposed to know which one was the experimental section. Although some people actually can figure it out. We get some tests where they answer every question correctly, and then on the experimental, they just go E. And we're trying to figure out how they do that, but that's another story. So on the experimental section, that's where we try out new items. And what they do is they test the items, and there's this thing called a Hansel-Mehta, it's a mathematical formula, where you take basically someone of this group, say gender, woman, versus man, of the same ability, and see how they score on an item. And if there's a difference, like men get it better, men of that ability get the answer 80% of the time, women of that ability get the answer 60% of the time, they throw it out. There's a statistical difference in the way it's answered based on a comparison between groups, you throw out the item. And so they do that for all subgroups. They do it for gender, they do it for race, and they do it for ethnicity, because we call Hispanics ethnicity and not race. And while I was president, and when you find one of these, it's a big deal in the experimental section because it's very rare. When you find one of these, they actually, you know, have to bring it to the board. And during I was both president-elect and president for 2 years, and then past, so for 4 years, we had two items that showed up with the diff analysis that we kicked out. One benefited African Americans, one didn't. And it was kind of interesting, the one that did, I can't tell you because they might use it in, but it definitely benefited. And anyway, this question. So they do diff analysis. So on each individual item, they can show that there is no differential outcome based on subgroups. Second thing, if you look at, once again, all of the other standardized tests, you see the same sort of gap. And therefore, in order to prove discrimination, you'd have to assume that all the test takers get together for every test, architecture, nursing, GRE, whatever, and they all get together and collude. And believe me, these people are not smart enough to do that. And so it's sort of problem. It's a standardized testing issue, not an LSAT issue. The third thing, and this you're not going to like, is that if the tests were discriminatory, it would have a different predictive validity. And so if you could show that African Americans would actually do better, but the test somehow masks their true ability because it discriminates against them, then it would have a poor predictive validity for African Americans. Unfortunately, it doesn't. It actually does better for African Americans than it does for whites. And so when you look at the test and we look at those three factors, the fact that diff analysis, the fact that all standardized tests have this issue and some a lot worse, and the test has pretty good predictive validity, even better for African Americans, it's not discriminatory. In fact, I would argue the LSAT is a very good test, one of the best, if not the best, sort of hot, what they call high stakes or power test, because it has a correlation of 0.43, which is very high. And when you couple that with the UGPA, it exceeds 0.50, which is pretty good for standardized tests. I can give you rattle off the GRE or GMAT, but they're less. So it's a good test. The real question, I don't have an answer to it, no one has an answer to it, is when you go through diff analysis, why then do you have the score scale differential between whites and blacks who have the same UGPA, who have the same socioeconomic status, who've gone to the same school, have the same major? We don't know. No one knows. And if I knew, I'd win the Nobel Prize. I'm serious. And so if I knew, I'd tell you. And I would fix it. And it's not as easy. Most people don't know this, but the SAT gender normed its test back in the 50s because they were seeing a differential between males and females. And so they consciously went in and said, let's make sure they come out the same. You can't do that with the SAT. That's not an issue. I mean, or the LSAT. And no one knows why the score scale still persists, but it's there. There's some hypothesis that has something to do with being subjected to discrimination. There's some anecdotal evidence that French Canadians in Canada who live in Toronto don't do as well as the British speaking, and go to Montreal, it flips. And so some stuff like that, but nobody knows. And so I can take questions about that, but I don't have an answer. It's there, the gap is there. So what does that mean? 0.43 correlation. 0.43 correlation, you have to square it. This is what the psychometricians tell me. And that means that if you square 0.4, 16% of your first year LGPA, law school grade point average, is attributable to the test. 84% is attributable to other factors. How much you like law schools, how much you study, whether you get along with your colleagues, whether you're having fights with your loved ones. And when you add basically undergraduate GPA, it comes up to about 20%. So basically 80% of grades that you achieve or students achieve are attributable to other factors. But that 16 to 20% is still very high for a standardized test. And what does that mean? If you had a class made up hypothetically of 100 students and 25 had 170, 25, 160, 25, 150, see where this is going, 25, 140, at the end of the first year, I'm going to get this a little bit wrong. I'll get some criticisms from my psychometrician friends. But 12 of these people would appear in the top quartile. Let me see. I think I got this right. 6 would appear in the second quartile of grades, 4 and 3. And so you could see being in this group, your odds of being in the top quartile in terms of your grades are very good. The numbers flip in the bottom quartile, 3, 4, 6, 12. So even if you're in the bottom quartile, 3 of these people will probably, even if you're in the bottom rank, 3 of these people will be in probably the top quartile. Although we'll see that doesn't really happen because we don't admit those people. So basically, the test will tell you that a certain percentage of these people will be spread along the range and will do so well, but it doesn't tell you which 12, and it doesn't tell you which 3 are not going to be in there, they're going to be in the bottom quartile. And that's the other factors that build into, how well you do in law school. And what the LSAT people do, let's see, I used to know this. I no longer am involved in admissions here at Virginia, so I can't speak to it directly. When I was dean at Minnesota, obviously I was involved in admissions there. Every school uses an index. I'm trying to remember what the index is here. It used to be 50 to 58. And the index is basically a mathematical formula which combines and weights your UGPA and your LSAT score. And so, the old one. I don't think we use this one anymore. The old one here at Virginia was weighted 60%, I believe, for UGPA and 40% for LSAT. And they went through a mathematical formula and it gave you a number between, don't hold me to this, but 48 and 60. And maybe it was a little bit lower than that. I think it might have been 40 to 60. I just didn't see any 40s. And what happens is, when I was on admissions, if you were 53, 54, 55 and you were in state, you got in. If you were 55, 56, 57 or above, you got in. If you were out of state. And what the LSAT people do is they take that number, your index number, and then they take your first year grades, okay, the grades you achieve, and what you should see on a very good test. Oh, at the end of the first year, the dean gets a report. It's called a correlation study, and you guys are just numbers. And it shows for everybody that's in the school that had an index of whatever, this was 50, the grade should be down here. This might be 2.3, and this might be 2.6, 2.9, you get the picture. And if you had a very good correlation, fact, if you had a perfect correlation, your graph would look like this. All of your students would be graphed along this axis. And so it would show you that the student who had the highest index had the best grades. And what actually happens when you get those, and I got those when I was dean at Minnesota, you see very strong correlations. You see outliers sometimes. You see things over here and things up here. But there's a lot of bunching around here. So that tells you it's a very good test. And it's one that people rely on. But so it demonstrates predictability. The one problem, which I'll come back to when we talk about admissions, is that the test has even stronger validity. You all remember the test had scores between 120 and 180? You know, you can get a 120. You want to get a 120, right? You sign your name, you get a 120. Now here's what's interesting. I looked this up. You remember this too, right? U.S. News and World Report. Virginia admits between 166 and 171. Now that's your 25th. 75th is 171. Now, I haven't gone in and looked, but I would hazard a guess, and I'm going to make the contention that there's, this is a guess, so don't sue me, but I can't guarantee it. I strongly believe that there's no one in the law school who got below a 155. Strongly believe no one in the law school got, and in fact, I can probably make the case that there's no one in the law school who got below a 160, and we'll talk about why. In a minute. Now, if that's the case, if there's no one in the law school who got below 160, and if, in fact, 75% of the people above 25, and in fact, I'm going to argue probably 90% of the people got between a 166 and a 171 or better, then you have a problem with this. And the problem is something they call range restriction. And it creates a skew. The range restriction is the test is based on 120 to 180, but all of you are between 166 and 171. So even though overall, because you're at the top in terms of the score, you're all fighting each other for grades, and we don't have a bottom. We don't have the 120s, the 130s, the 140s. So that chart that I had on the board before is invalid. You have all these 166s and 168s fighting it out, and somebody's got to be on the bottom, and somebody's got to be on the top. So when you do see variations, it's usually, not usually, but a lot of it is attributable to what they call range restriction because you don't admit 120 to 180. It's kind of fascinating, but we're giving the test now, as an aside, we're giving the test now in Australia and some other places, and they do have a whole range of people who take the test, and Australia law is an undergraduate discipline, and there you see much higher validity because you have an entire range of applicants taking the test and matriculating at the various schools and getting grades. So the 125s, 130s are on the bottom, and the 170s and 180s are on the top. So, LSAT's a good test, one of the best. It's not the end-all, be-all. It's only a number. Maybe count 16% of what it takes to get a grade. And so that leads to the question, what's the problem? Why have African-Americans not been admitted to law schools at a higher rate given the increased number of seats? Two problems. One, Grutter. And Grutter was a victory. But before Grutter was decided, the deans all thought, I shouldn't say all, most of the deans thought that Grutter would come out the other way. And so many of the deans changed their admissions processes to reflect basically a race-neutral admissions process. Some were required to under their state law, like Michigan, like California, but many of them, being fearful of potential lawsuits, just changed their policies so that race was no longer a variable in their process. And even after Grutter, those deans, many of these deans, have chosen not, for various reasons, threat of lawsuits. Some have a belief in fairness, not to take race into account, leading to a race-neutral process. And then when you couple that with the differential in scores, African Americans overall are at a disadvantage compared to white applicants. The second problem, which I think is the real problem and not that problem, is this one. U.S. News, okay? And U.S. News is the bane of most deans' existence. Deans have been fired, literally, over not improving or falling in U.S. News and World Report. And if you care about U.S. News and World Report, it contains a number of different variables upon which schools are evaluated. The metric
that U.S. News uses, and the guy who puts this together is a nice guy. He comes to the dean's meeting, he explains what they're going to do. You look at the metric. When I was the dean, you try to manipulate the metric so that you can take advantage, obviously, and not game the system, but achieve the best rating you can. The best, or not the best, the most heavily weighted attribute of U.S. News rankings is reputational. 40% of it's reputational. I think it's 25% by 25% by judges and lawyers, 15% by academics. And the next most heavily weighted component is admissions, which comes in at 12.5%. Now, here's what happens. Around this time, in fact, it should be starting about now, all of the law professors in the world, especially in this country, and all the deans in this country, get flooded with what we call law porn. Okay, and law porn is glossy brochures and things from other law schools saying how great they are. You know, like, this is the best program of trial ed in the world. And here are glossy pictures of X, Y, and Z. This is, you know, here are our grads. They're all employed. They're all doing great things. Every school, and I shouldn't say every school. I can't prove that. Most schools in the United States spend thousands of dollars on this stuff. Guess where it goes? Circular, okay? Everybody throws it away. But people spend money on it. And people try to improve their reputation. But because of some things called echo effects and some other things, it doesn't work. The one thing that deans think they can control is that admissions variable. And there are three reasons why they think they can control that admissions variable. The first is cost. To improve your reputation, another big variable also worth 12.5% is the resources that you spend per student. So there's actually a calculation. You take a budget, you divide it by the number of students, and it gives you roughly how much you spend per student. And that's a big one. Here we spend about, I'm guessing, I used to know the number. Here we spend about $65,000, $70,000 per student. So see, you're even though you're paying $40,000, still a good deal. Right? At Yale, they spend about $150,000 per student. At Harvard, they spend $100,000. So that goes into, well, $70,000 is not bad. In Minnesota, we only spend about $40,000. You could be worse. You could be on the other end of the ledger. We're spending $20,000, you're paying $40,000. But that, no. So you're getting a good deal. If you want to increase that, then you're talking millions of dollars. If you want to increase your reputation, you're talking millions of dollars. But when you're talking about increasing your median LSAT score or your 75th and 25th percentile, all you need to do is tell your dean of admissions, I want that score to go up. I don't want you to admit, so that we wind up with a 167 next year and a 172. And it's very easy to do. I mean, it's very mathematically, you get these applications in, you admit people, they accept, and then you keep people on the waiting list, and eventually you wind up with the numbers you want at a very low cost. The other thing is certainty. These numbers are certain. You can, as a dean, say, I want to have a 167 next year and a 172. And if you don't, I never had this conversation with my admissions officer, you will be fired. I know deans who've had that conversation with their admissions officer or their admissions staff, and those numbers have better go up, but it's certain. You look at the numbers. You admit a class, if you admit my 100, what this means, if you admit my 100 students, the 75th student has to have a 166, and all the 75 students that you've admitted, or 74 students you've admitted before her, have to be 166 or better. And you can do that, it's very easy to do. And I can do it. When I was dean, I did it. And so you can get that number and achieve certainty. You cannot achieve the same certainty with things like reputation. There's no way you can, you know, gauge whether you're really affecting your reputation, whether your message is coming across, or whether you've made a tremendous mistake. So deans like that number. The third thing, where it is correlation. We call it 3 C's. At one point, although I noticed this year it was a little bit off, there was an exact correlation between the school's rankings and the LSAT score. And deans see that. And so, where's the page here? Schools of Law, Yale, number one, 08 LSAT score, 25th and 75th percentile, 169 and 177. Harvard, 176. Then you go down the list, and so there's almost a perfect correlation. It wasn't this year, but there has been in the past. There's one school, I won't say which one, better not get in trouble, that you don't have the correlation, but they did something different. So anyway, deans see that, and they say, well, it can affect that number. Here's what happens. If you want to shoot for this number, and you say this is our 25th percentile number, What that means, if you're admitting 24 students below that in my hypothetical 100-person class, you can admit whomever you want with whatever LSAT score you want, and they will not affect this number because, by definition, your 25th percentile is 166. So you would think that would give you a range to admit people from, say, 140 to 166, and you can do whatever you want on that 25 percentile, but people don't do it. Deans don't do it. Admissions officers don't do it. They don't do it for three reasons. One, they're afraid of being sued. If they admit only students of color in this range, they might get sued. Two, they like the numbers. They don't understand math. That's why they went to law school. You can tell deans until they're blue in the face. You can experiment below this number. They don't see that. They see, oh, my 25th percentile is 166. Ooh, I better not admit at 164. That'll affect it. Ooh, I better not admit at 150. That'll affect it. And you'll say, no, no, no. I'm sorry. I know you don't have a math degree, but you can do that. And they say, no, no, no. I have to admit 165, 160. Oh, you will see schools, and I've seen schools, where if they have these numbers, there will hardly be anybody below 166. The 25th percentile will be basically the first percentile. And deans are, and they just get caught up in that. They also think that if they do it this way, if they admit a 172, it'll change it. The other thing, and maybe this is perhaps a good reason, and we can talk about this in the Q&A, you clearly don't want to admit a 140 to compete with all the 166s. So at some point, if you're a principal dean, even if you know that you can't admit below the 166, and that you should admit, especially if you want to diversify, if you want to give people a chance, you're still going to try and stay close to these numbers because you don't want to put anyone at a competitive disadvantage and say, gee, you're my 150. You're the only 150 in the class. The odds are almost overwhelming that you are going to wind up in the bottom quartile of this class. Might you be better off going to another law school where your median, where your 150 is close to the median or maybe even at the top? And so a principal dean could come up with a rationale for not diversifying along the spectrum. There are some principal deans. Most of them, however, just don't know the math, and they just try and stick close to this number. And so that's what happens in the admissions process. And so the impact on admissions, when you couple the score scale differential together with U.S. News and World Report and this pressure for the rankings. When I went to law school, there was no U.S. News. I mean, it was very different how you chose a law school. I've had students come to my office during Admitted Students Week and say, well, 1 year, I guess we're number 10 now, but 1 year we were number 8 and NYU was number 7. And they said, why should I come here? You're number 8, NYU 7. And I'm like, hello, this is Charlottesville. That's New York. Isn't that a reason to, you know, try and compare these schools? No, they're number 7, you're number 8. And that pressure is just, you know, I won't ask you how many of you came here because this was the highest ranked school you got in. But that has changed the game. The metric has changed. We, unlike other schools, have one evaluator. We're unlike business schools who have four or six different measurements. They measure on different metrics. We're also, law schools are unlike business schools or colleges. We're all the same. And we're all the same because of something else you don't know. The standards and rules for procedure for approval of law schools, the ABA section of legal education and admissions to the bar. This is the group that the Department of Education has tapped to be the accreditor under federal law. The Department of Education has to have an accrediting body. The Department of Education decides for each type of school whom will be or the accrediting body. For us, it's the ABA section on legal education. And the ABA section on legal education basically mandates, if you want to know why all of the 200 ABA-approved schools look pretty much alike, it's because of this. And so since we all look alike, since we all teach the same thing, since we all use the same admissions process, since we all have the same curriculum, we're very easy to measure. We're very easy to compare. We're very easy to say, oh, Yale's number 1, Virginia's number 10, and differences turn on that. And so that's really part of the problem. The other problem is, once you know what these numbers look like, and I don't want to depress you, but I used to have the exact numbers, and I emailed my head psychometrician at Newtown this morning to get the exact numbers. But guess what I discovered? Unlike here in Virginia, the rest of the world is on holiday. So I was assuming I'd get these numbers. They never came because it hit me, oh my God, they're closed today, because I even called after I didn't get the email reply. Because as being former chair, there is some respect. Anyway, so I called him and I said, I emailed him and I said, Peter, his name's Peter Pashley. I knew these numbers 5 years ago. I don't know them now. Tell me the number of African Americans who scored above a 170 in the last administration cycle. So the last administration cycle would be the one, I can't remember now, it's February to the four cycles. And the number used to be, the last time I checked, it was 125. But I'd be charitable. Say it's 150. So 150, that's the other way, above 170. And then you have, last time I looked, then you have about another 250 above 160, and then you have about 500 above 153, which is the median. And this is out of 7,000 test takers, roughly. And so what you see here, if this is our pool here at Virginia, this is what we're looking to, and these are guesses. They're not that far off. I mean, it's not hugely different. It may be some up, some down. We're looking at basically 400, maybe 500 students in any year who take the test who do above 160. And you're looking at about 800, 900 who do above the median. If you think about the top 20 law schools, Minnesota, number 20, their median LSAT was 160. So everybody's chasing these students. I mean, everyone is chasing all of these students. And all of these students are receiving, no doubt, hopefully, great financial aid packages. And that's another story. We've also changed the way we finance legal education. The students who are not sought after basically pay for the other students. That's why tuition is $40,000. It's a have and have not model of financing. So you have all half your class usually on free rides, the ones that you want, the high scores, those who diversify, and then you have the other half, the low scores, the ones who don't diversify, who pay for the rest. It's a fun world, all due to U.S. News and World Report. The last piece of this, and I'm running out of time, I want to leave ample time for question. And all this, in fact, I should have mentioned this. I wrote about all of this in an article. And the article is, let me give you the site in case you care to read about this. The destruction of the holistic approach to admissions, the pernicious effect of rankings. And it's an 81 Indiana Law Journal, 309 in 2006. And so all of that's laid out with some empirics and some, obviously, more detail in that article. I've just finished a new article that's going to appear in the Journal of Legal Education. And in that article, I run through some other numbers. And what I discovered is that roughly, I don't know how to approach this as quickly as I'd like. If you look at the individuals who take the LSAT after they graduate from college, it is clear that law schools get their fair share of interest. Let's see, I wrote it down somewhere. In any given year, 22.5% of bachelor's degrees are awarded to members of underrepresented groups, with 9% to African Americans. The good news is 32.5% of LSAT test takers during 1999 to 2000, which is the last year we have statistics, 11.5% were African Americans. So we're attracting more African Americans to take the test than are graduating from law school, from undergraduate schools. Of that number, and that was 9,400 and something, of the number of test takers, roughly 75% choose to make an application to a law school. And when you look at the numbers, that means 7,300 basically choose to apply to law schools, and that number is comparable to both whites, Hispanics, and Asian Americans. So if you look at the pipeline for students of color, at that point in the pipeline, the numbers aren't skewed. They're about the same, proportionally. So about 25% of the people who take the test, whether they're white, black, whatever, choose not to apply. And they choose not to apply for a lot of reasons. They got a low score, they got a better score on this test, they got a better opportunity, they're going to business school, they may be applying 2 years, but they don't apply that year. Does that make sense so far? Okay, then what's interesting is if you look at the 74,500 people who applied in the year 2000, once again, that's the year that I have data on. When you look at the people who were admitted, 65% of the white applicants were admitted, but only 54% of the Hispanic applicants and only 43% of the African-American applicants were admitted. That's where you see the drop. That's where you see the gap. And so we're getting applicants, we're getting people to take the test, which obviously they have to do. You're getting applicants, but you're not getting matriculants. And I don't have enough time to go into this, but this in this article that's coming out in the Journal of Legal Education this year, I don't have a site obviously, one of the things that I try to document is that African Americans disproportionately when compared to whites and even Hispanics misapply to law schools. They apply to the wrong law schools. We get, for example, here in Virginia, at least when I was on the committee, we would get over 200 applicants every year with below a 150 LSAT. And although we don't have a cutoff score, nobody has a cutoff score because that's not good, not one of those people got in. And when I was dean of Minnesota, I saw the same phenomenon. Our median was 163, and we would get applicants 143, 148, 150. If those same applicants had applied to their two other schools, three now in Minneapolis, William Mitchell, Hamlin, and St. Thomas, three of which basically have medians of 155, those students would have gotten in to any one of those three schools. But by applying to Minnesota, you're not going to get in. And what I can show and what I try and demonstrate in this article is that people misapply. They apply to the wrong schools, schools that they have no shot at getting in, and then they're given bad advice. They're told, if you don't go to Harvard, if you don't go to Virginia, if you don't go to Minnesota, you shouldn't go to law school. You shouldn't go to a second tier, third tier, whatever tier law school. You can't get into the best. So today, actually, we joke about this. Well, I used to joke about it when I was dean. There's a law seat for everybody. In fact, some schools have some vacant seats. And so we say there's a law school for everybody, but you have to pick the right law school. And so one of the things that I attempt to document is that African Americans are given bad advice. I don't know if it's a factor of their belief that affirmative action means that irrespective of the LSAT, you'll get into Harvard or Virginia or Yale or Michigan or whatever. Don't know. But it's clear that's also part of the problem. And if people were given correct and actual good advice, they would be better off. There is some hope. And this I'll conclude with and leave 10 minutes. All of this is created by a standard in the ABA section. In fact, I could have started with this. There's a standard in here called 503. And 503, let me read it to you. Here it is. Standard 503 says, a law school shall require each applicant for admission as a first-year JD student to take a valid and reliable admission test to assist the school and the applicant in assessing the applicant's capability of satisfactorily completing the school's educational program. It goes on, but then there's an interpretation. A law school that uses an admission test other than the law school admission test sponsored by the LSAC shall establish that such other test is a valid and reliable test. So basically, when you put those two together, that means every school has to use the LSAT. And that score gets reported to the ABA and is therefore verifiable. And that's why that score is in here. Well, what the ABA section is debating right now is to eliminate the LSAT from the admissions process. There is a huge debate, and apparently I've been told that it's going to pass, that they're going to eliminate standard 503. And no longer are schools going to be required to use an admissions test, or no longer are they going to be directed, if you will, to use the LSAT. And I haven't decided whether that's a good or a bad thing, because we may go back to a world where it's who you know and where you went to school and, you know, who your friend is and who your daddy knows, as opposed to, can you perform? So it could be a whole new ball game in a couple of years, and maybe as early as this year. And all of this may be moot. We'll see.